171315 et al., Carroll College, Inc., petitioner versus National Labor Relations Board. Mr. Brill for the petitioner, Mr. Goldstein for the respondent, Ms. Trafton for the intervener.
Mr. Brill, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Edward Brill, and I represent the petitioner, Carroll College, which is a small Christian college located in Waukesha, Wisconsin. Your Honors, the NLRB's order directing the college to bargain with a union representing its faculty should not be enforced by this court for two reasons. First, the college is altogether exempt from the NLRB's jurisdiction under the Supreme Court's decision in Catholic Bishop
but,
and this
but
court's.
You've conceded that you didn't make that argument, the Catholic Bishop argument, to the board, right?
That's correct.
And how do we get around 10E, which says that if you don't make an argument to the board, you don't get to make it here?
Well, Your Honor, we're
you
not asking
you haven't argued. You haven't argued that there are extraordinary circumstances here, have you?
Well, we think we have.
Where have you argued that?
We think we have, Your Honor. The 10E itself contains a proviso which obviously is intended to give the courts authority to consider arguments that were not presented to the board appropriately below.
But this wasn't simply an argument that was not presented. It was an argument that you expressly disavowed. Well, now that is maybe that's the extraordinary circumstance.
Well, no, I think the extraordinary circumstance here is a combination of three principal factors. First, the jurisdictional argument was plainly raised at the outset of the hearing, and the factual hearing addressed.
That's a stretch. Your briefing to the board says we are not relying on Catholic Bishop. So I'm not interested in an argument, maybe the others are, about that goes contrary to that. I want to know, what's the extraordinary circumstance?
Well, the extraordinary circumstance is that the cases say one of the reasons for 10E, Your Honor, okay, one of the principal purposes for 10E is to allow the agency the opportunity to develop a factual record on the issue. And here, the factual record was developed. And in fact, at the time of the hearing,
the factual record was developed on a RFRA claim, right?
No, the factual record was developed on the Catholic Bishop claim. In fact, the two issues were the same. At the time of the hearing and at the time of the request for review, the board applied a single test. It didn't separate that test until the decision on review in this case. But the words RFRA never appear in the transcript of the hearing. Mr. Leffler started out the case by saying, I am raising a jurisdictional defense that this board has no jurisdiction over the college as a religious institution. That's a Catholic bishop defense. And the UAW understood
it. Beyond that statement, what else did he say? And the answer is nothing. He didn't say anything about that. He made that one reference, and that was it.
Well,
And from there, he goes on and argues about managerial employees. I don't see how you can maintain that this argument was ever placed in front of the board. But
well, I'm not saying the argument was placed in front of the regional director. He decided it. He in his decision, he says the first issue I'm deciding was whether or not the board has whether or not the NLRB has jurisdiction over the college. And he says under Catholic Bishop, as interpreted by the board, I apply a substantial religious character test, and I find that the college doesn't meet that test. Now, the truth is that the college didn't meet the substantial religious character test. Whatever the judgment was made at that time, Mr. Leffler, in his brief to the board, said, we think that you can decide this case without reaching the Catholic bishop issue, the Great Falls issue, because RFRA is a simpler test. I think he was wrong in retrospect, But he did not concede the issue. He did not concede there was jurisdiction. He basically was telling the board, I'm making a different argument. But they're very closely intertwined arguments, and the facts are basically the same. And what the cases say is that the purpose of 10E is to allow the administrative agency to develop a factual record, which it did here, and make facts, which it did. And the second reason why we think that we fall within the proviso of Section 10E is that this is not an issue for administrative discretion or expertise. This court said in Great Falls, the application of Catholic bishop is a question for judicial decision. We do not defer to the administrative discretion or the administrative expertise of the NLRB. There's nothing here for the NLRB to do that wasn't done. They found the facts. We're not asking this court to find any facts that were not found by the NLRB. What we're saying is, excuse me, take the facts that were found by the NLRB. In fact, if you read the first seven pages of the college's brief to the board, you can't read those seven pages. It just leaps out at you that this is a religious institution. I mean, it's really, if the board easily could have said, well, we find the college fails the RFRA test, but it's clear to us on this record that we have no jurisdiction over this institution if they were to apply the Great Falls test. All we're asking this court to do is to say, we know the test. It's our judicial responsibility to apply this test. There's nothing more for the board to do. We take the facts that were found by the board. Those facts easily satisfy the three-part test that we established in Great Falls. And there's no harm that's done to the policies of Section 10E. The board, in its brief, very interestingly, never addresses our principal argument, which is that this is an extraordinary case. I never saw any other case like this. The two cases that they cite, the Polynesian Cultural Center case and the hospital case, which involved somewhat comparable issues of the application of Catholic bishop, in both of those cases, the courts relied on the fact that the board was never given the opportunity to develop a factual record. That was the basis of their holdings. And the third reason I think that this case really cries out for the board to apply the proviso of Section 10E is that the whole purpose of Catholic bishop, and as applied by this court in Great Falls, was to avoid a difficult constitutional issue. That is, if we interpret the statute to apply to a religious institution, then we have to address the First Amendment issue. Now, if the college is deemed to have waived the statutory question, the First Amendment issue is lurking there. It's coming up. And it seems to me that is exactly the kind of unusual circumstance that should lead to a decision that we can decide the statutory issue now on this record. There's no further fact-finding needed. And if we do that, we're avoiding a very difficult First Amendment issue. The whole purpose of Catholic bishop, the whole purpose of Great Falls, is to avoid forcing decision of those constitutional issues. And so we say, given those three principal reasons, the facts are found.
Would you agree that you can waive a jurisdictional argument under 10E if it's not brought up?
Yes, we're not saying that if the only issue here, there's some suggestion in the cases which we cited that say in certain circumstances, if the board has no jurisdiction at all, then that can't be waived. The Alwyn case says that. Even the Noel case of this court says that. We're not relying on that doctrine. I think the fact that this is a legal jurisdictional issue is one of the factors that goes into 10E. If the record hadn't been made here, if the jurisdictional issue hadn't been raised and decided at the regional director level, it would be a different case. And I'm not arguing that in and of itself, the fact that it's a jurisdictional issue is enough to get us past 10E or that jurisdiction can never be waived. That's not the rule in this court. So that's not what we're arguing. We're saying there's a combination of circumstances here. And really, what
I thought the rule for us on these matters was that if it's a jurisdictional issue, it needs to be patently obvious that it's beyond the board's jurisdiction. Is that not right?
That's the way the courts have phrased it.
So what is patently obvious about this?
Well, I think that, first of all, that's in terms of that if the only issue is jurisdictional and there's no other factors that get you under 10E and you're only looking at the jurisdictional question, I think what's patently obvious is two things, Your Honor. First, in Great Falls, this court said it was a question of whether the college was, quote, altogether exempt from the board's jurisdiction, completely exempt. And secondly, it was patently obvious to the board when this record came up before them, it was should have been patently obvious on their own finding that this was a religious institution. What if a railroad had come up to the board, Your Honor? A small railroad had come up, and nobody ever raised the fact that it was subject to the Railway Labor Act. And the board nonetheless went ahead, and nobody raised the issue that it was a Railway Labor Act issue. They don't have jurisdiction because it's a railroad.
I understand that. I'm still stuck on the fact that you were the one that said Catholic bishop doesn't apply here.
We didn't say Catholic. No, but that, I think if you read the record carefully, I think the government has misstated. The only place where anything like that was said was is referenced, and we responded to this in a footnote in our reply brief. Mr. Leffler said, and this was in his request for review, he said, the regional director found that decided an issue that we didn't raise in our post-hearing brief. He said,
here's what I'm looking at. I'm looking at, in the red brief, the addendum, page 2, which is the brief of Carroll College in support of dismissal of the petition before the NLRB. Paragraph. One final matter.
What page is this, Your Honor?
It's in the red brief, the addendum 2.
Page 2 of the addendum?
Page 2 of the addendum.
Right.
And the paragraph reads, one final matter outside the scope of the NLRA. Carroll is not claiming that the college is not an employer within the meaning of 2.2.2 because of the institution's religious foundations, and the site is to NLRB versus Catholic bishops.
Right, that's very true, but there's a difference between not claiming the argument and waiving the argument, and later on, in this brief or in the principal brief on review, this was a...
What is the difference between saying we're not relying on Catholic bishop and then not waiving that argument?
Well, what he said was, in a passage that we quote, he said, the board, because we believe that we're exempt under RFRA as a statutory matter, the court doesn't need to reach the more difficult issue that would be posed under Catholic bishop and Great Falls, and he cited those two cases. So, it may be a fine distinction, but I think what he was trying to say is, I'm trying to drive my truck through RFRA, and I think it's easier for you to decide this under RFRA than it is under Catholic bishop and Great Falls. He was wrong, and he should have had a footnote that says, I reserve my rights under Catholic bishop, which he didn't do. I'm not suggesting that 10E, that the proviso to 10E applies because the conduct of counsel was excusable. What I'm saying is that, in fact, in the few cases where the proviso has been applied, for example, the NLRB v. FLRA case, which is, it's not cited in our briefs, but I think it's discussed in some of the cases that we do cite, and that's 2F3rd 1190, a decision of this court, where it was the NLRB itself that failed to raise an issue in its review of a Federal Labor Relations Authority decision. It wasn't, the decision wasn't based on the justification that the board's attorney had for not raising the issue. The court said, under the circumstances of that case, it would have really been futile for the NLRB to go back to the FLRA. We're not saying there's a futility argument here, but
what's your most power? If we were looking at it under Great Falls, what's your most powerful argument that the college is exempt under Great Falls?
Well, the board itself found that the college has a sincerely held purpose to instill Christian values in its students, and it meets every.
Is that sufficient? I thought under Great Falls you need to hold yourself out as a school that has a religious environment, religious educational environment.
Right.
Might that not be different? Religious educational environment versus the purpose that you just cited.
Well, the court held itself, the college held itself out publicly to students, to faculty, and to the public, I think was the exact quote.
As what? As having a religious
As a religious institution, which is
That's not the issue.
Well, I think that actually, I think the way
as a religious educational environment, did they do that?
I think they did, but I think the test as
where did they do it?
I think the test as it was actually stated by the religious educational environment language actually was the language used by Judge Breyer in the Bayamon case, but the test as adopted
which was adopted by
no, but the test as actually as stated by this court at the end of its decision, it was hold itself out to the public as a religious institution. But however phrased, it clearly does hold itself out to the public, both in terms exactly the same way that
let's take the Breyer test. How does it hold itself out as providing a religious educational environment? How does it do that?
Well, it does it through its catalog, through the faculty manual, through its public association with the Presbyterian Church. If you look at the covenant itself, which is in the faculty manual,
the mere fact of affiliation holding itself out as providing a religious educational environment, doesn't that say something about the content of the courses approach? What does it mean?
I don't think at all that that's what
you're. You think mere affiliation satisfies the Breyer standard?
Well, affiliation is one aspect. This court said, Your Honor, in Great Falls, that if a college has a one of the purposes of the institution is to provide a religious education, that in itself is enough to satisfy the test, because the court is not going to second guess what level of religion exists within the institution.
I understand that, but I'm trying to make a distinction between saying that you have historic religious connections and saying that you are providing a religious education environment. That seems different to me.
Well, you know, it's not a question of how many crosses there are in the classrooms or whether you require students or faculty to adhere to a certain religion. This was a mainstream Protestant institution, and the values, the Christian values that were being promulgated as reflected in all of the documents were not dogmatic religious principles, but were encouraging in
What is that after? My question is, what have they said? How have they held themselves out to the public to provide a religious education environment? Not that they've held themselves out to the public that they have a historic affiliation with the church.
No, this is not historic. This is a current.
Or even a current.
Well, like to save a few minutes for rebuttal, and I'll get the exact passages. But the mission statement, which is in the college catalog, the front cover of the college catalog that goes to everyone to the public, says in Latin, for Christ, learning in Christ, or Christ in learning.
And that's sufficient to say that we're providing a religious education?
Well, I don't know whether one thing in itself is sufficient, but they also say that one of their mission statements is to provide a secular education and to enforce or encourage education through the expression of Christian values. I don't think you need to. The court said in Great Falls, we're not going to troll through the record to see how religious the institution is or what kind of religion is involved here. Unless there's other questions now.
I want you to address the managerial issue.
Excuse me?
I want you to address the managerial issue.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. If the court does find that there's a jurisdiction over the college, we believe that the regional director's decision and the board's decision enforcing that really totally misstated the record on managerial status of the faculty and was completely inconsistent with other board decisions, principally Lemoyne Owen College, which is really closely similar to this case in almost every significant respect. And let me just focus on, if Your Honor will give me the time, on two or three principal issues that the board relied on, I think, incorrectly. On the issue of curriculum and course development, which we think is the central academic factor, the board, the regional director found, and the board relied on the fact that 10 years before the hearing, at a time of extreme financial crisis in the institution, which the board admits in its brief, the college was losing $1 million a year, the president was fired, the institution was in danger of being shut down, 6 majors were eliminated for financial reasons over the objections of the faculty. That does not, over the ensuing 10 years, Every recommendation by the faculty from 8 new majors, 2 new master's programs was adopted. Every course recommended by the faculty was adopted. The only exception, the only significant exception, was this one elimination of a group of majors 10 years earlier for financial reasons. And Yeshiva is very clear, and the board cases are clear, that that's exactly the kind of decision for financial reasons and institutional concerns that do not detract from a faculty's managerial status.
How about this January term?
Well, the January term...
Yes,
it was financial, and it's exactly the same kind of decision. In fact, in the Lewis and Clark case, which is one of the cases that's cited in our brief, the administration of the college made a number of changes, including elimination of departments, establishing a new graduate school, and changing to a semester system from a term system, all without the faculty's involvement. And the board said at that time, these are the types of decisions that administration makes. What you need to look at is, do the faculty significantly control the academics of the institution? And they do here. If you put aside these 6 majors, which are really irrelevant, the only other example of any decision by the faculty, supposed decision that wasn't followed, was there was a special task force to investigate international programming. And there was there's like a page of testimony about this in which the faculty member says, we made a number of recommendations, including establishing area programs like Latin American studies, and nothing ever happened to it. That's the extent of the testimony.
Let me ask you this. It may be true that what I was looking at was the faculty objecting to things like the termination of all the department heads and these 3 coordinators or whatever, and being
right.
ignored in the objections rather than the administration accepting what the faculty recommended in the first place. It seemed to me that the administration, with this new president, suddenly weakened the faculty, or cut the faculty out, really, and then the faculty was in the position of having to object to these various things,
mm-hmm.
and they remained the way they were.
Well, what they objected to, Your Honor, were structural changes, and there's no doubt that there was a dispute between the administration and the faculty over the role the faculty would have in those types of decisions. But Yeshiva teaches, and Lewis and Clark couldn't be any more clear on this from the board, that the faculty doesn't need to run the institution. It doesn't need to have the same power as the president. It just needs to have the effective control over the academics. And that's exactly what it had here. And the other area where the board inappropriately tries to diminish that authority, and in fact is again inconsistent with its own decisions in Lemoyne Owen College, for example, is to say that, well, the fact that the faculty developed all these courses and the fact that they developed all these majors doesn't count because the provost was involved early on to see whether the courses were consistent with the college's general direction and financial resources. Well, if you know anything about colleges and universities, that's what provosts do. That's their whole function. And the very same argument was made in Lemoyne Owen and was rejected by the board. It's really inconceivable how the board, in this case, can rely on an argument that they rejected in their most recent decision, which is Lemoyne Owen. So we think if you strip away these structural decisions on the one hand, and also the financial decision to eliminate the 6 departments that was made 10 years earlier, what you have, even by the regional director's own finding, is really an unbroken record of faculty operating through committees elected by faculty, deciding on the core curriculum, deciding on the curriculum in each one of the colleges, deciding on courses, and having a whole range of other academic authority.
Let me ask you about, and I may be confused about this, but the one thing that struck me in the beginning was the faculty itself decided it was going from 4 courses to 3 courses, or 4-hour courses to 3-hour
right.
courses. And it seemed to me that if you were in any other employment situation, it would be like the employee saying, well, we're not coming in from 8 to 5, we're coming in from noon to 5. And so that seemed to me to be pretty strong evidence of non-employee, of managerial. But that was done before this new administration.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And has that been, I didn't see anything in the record that had been tinkered with in any way.
It wasn't that. There's no evidence that that authority was changed one way or the other, either that the faculty wanted to change the load or the administration wanted to change the load.
Any other questions? Thank you. We'll give you a couple minutes in reply.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Goldstein?
May it please the court, my name is Stephen Goldstein, attorney for the National Labor Relations Board, which is seeking enforcement of its order. The board found that the college violated the act by refusing to bargain with the union, even though the union had won an election among the college's faculty members. Since the college admits that it has refused to bargain, the question before the court is whether the board erred in certifying the union. Now, the college first claims that the board never should have certified the union because the board lacks jurisdiction over it under this court's Great Falls test for determining when a school is altogether exempt from board jurisdiction as a religious institution. But as the court's already recognized, the court is precluded from considering this argument under Section 10E because the college never raised that argument to the board, even though this court had decided Great Falls 2 years before the union filed its election petition in this case. Indeed, the college concedes that it never raised it to the board. Now, the college seeks to get around Section 10E.
Now, in your red brief, you said something stronger than that, and I want to ask you about it. On page 35, you say that that not only did they disclaim any reliance on a Catholic bishop defense, quote, and explicitly conceded that the board had jurisdiction over it. Where did they explicitly concede that?
Well, if you look at addendum page 8, which is attached to our brief, in the red brief, there's a paragraph number 2. And the sentence beginning with the last word on first line of paragraph 2, it says the board has jurisdiction, whatever that means, over Carroll.
Now, I'm sorry, I'm not seeing that. I'm looking at your addendum?
Yes, addendum page 8.
Okay.
A paragraph that has a number 2 before it, it's at the last full paragraph on the page.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, try me again.
All right, so we're on addendum page 8.
Right.
On the final paragraph on the page, which has a number 2 before it.
Yes.
The last word on the first line is the. It says the board has jurisdiction over Carroll.
Whatever that means, right. Over Carroll.
And in addition, when the acting regional director dropped a footnote and said, I would define that we have jurisdiction even if I were to apply this court's Great Falls test, it couldn't have been easier for the employer to say in its request for review, we take issue with that. But they didn't do it. And so when the board issued its order on the employer's request for review and adopted the portion of this court's Great Falls opinion dealing with RFRA, the board explicitly stated, we need not pass on the D.C. Circuit's rejection of the board's test for determining jurisdiction under Catholic bishop because the employer had expressly conceded jurisdiction. The employer never filed an exception to the board's decision and never filed a motion for reconsideration saying, you got it wrong, we didn't concede it. They remained silent. And it's true that they were represented by different counsel, but the very first time they ever raised this issue was in their opening brief to this court. Now, the college seeks to...
their argument about extraordinary circumstances, being constituted by the fact that there's no factual record that needs to be developed. We have everything right here to look at the jurisdictional issue.
Well, I think the short and sufficient response to that is that even if all the facts necessary to apply Great Falls were already in the record, the argument would still have to be rejected because it runs right smack up against the express language of the board's rules and regulations, which presuppose that an argument can indeed be deemed waived even if it was fully litigated at the initial level before a hearing officer. After all, Section 102.67F of the board's rules and regulations states, quote, failure to request review shall preclude such parties from relitigating in any related subsequent unfair labor practice proceeding any issue which was raised in the representation case proceeding. So that express language presupposes that the issue was litigated at the initial level.
Yeah, but are the cases that have talked about extraordinary circumstances say if it is, it's patently obvious that there's no jurisdiction.
Well, I think the language comes from perhaps is Cheney, where the, if it's patently, if the board has patently traveled outside the outer orbit of its authority, then the courts can step in. But as the Ninth Circuit noted, I believe in the Polynesian cultural case, as long as the board's purporting to decide a labor dispute, the board has not traveled outside, patently traveled outside the orbit of its authority, and there's no dispute that this case does involve a labor dispute. It's over whether the employers violated the act by refusing to bargain.
I think the argument would be that it's clear that under Great Falls that this is an entity that is not under the jurisdiction of the NLRB. That's the argument. It's patently obvious, or whatever the phrase is.
Their example, as it was, I believe, to this morning, was that if a railroad comes before the board doesn't have authority over railroads. They're covered by a separate statute of the Railway Labor Act. But unlike the employer and Catholic bishop, it certainly isn't patently obvious that this employer is a religious organization. No religious organization owns the college. No religious organization.
That's not necessary under Great Falls. Ownership isn't necessary.
No, that's true.
If they bring the claim under Great Falls, they win, right? I mean, Great Falls tells us that we don't need to go into the type of inquiry that you suggested, that we don't need to go into the type of inquiry that the board went through. We look at the way they hold themselves out to the public.
Among other things. And the only thing
They have to be non-profit. You don't dispute that they're non-profit, that they're affiliated with a religious entity.
Well,
right? There's no dispute about that.
Well, there's no dispute that they're non-profit. That's a factual.
And that they're affiliated with the board,
I mean, it would be inappropriate for me to comment on this because the board expressly declined any consideration of this issue because it hadn't been raised. And moreover, the employer conceded jurisdiction under Catholic bishop. But I don't think it's fair to say that it would be entirely, I mean, it's entirely inconceivable that a fact finder could find that the three-part test, wasn't satisfied here. I mean,
well, let's talk about the first one. How could they find that the first one wasn't satisfied? That they hold themselves out to the public as a
religious. You have to provide a religious educational environment.
What I want to ask, though, is there evidence that the general counsel might have put in had the Catholic Bishop Great Falls issue been clearly raised that it did not put in?
Well, a representation case proceeding is non-adversarial. The board does. There's no counsel from the NLRB even present at the hearing to put on evidence, so it would be up to the petitioner, and perhaps these questions might be better directed to it. But when you look at the Great Falls opinion, you'll see that the court...
So let me just follow through on that. In other words, the general counsel had no opportunity to present any evidence, and we don't know what he or she might have presented. In other words, you're saying it's a one-party proceeding before the regional director.
Well, it's two, the employer and the union, two parties.
The union, yes. But, I mean, the board is not there other than through the
hearing
regional
officer.
Director.
Right. Or his designee, yes.
So I'm just trying to be clear about this. Whether or not the argument is all the facts were found that are necessary to decide the Great Falls issue. And as I understand your point, or maybe it's not your point, but I'm just trying to be clear in my own mind, that the general counsel before the board, had the issue been addressed by the board, would have been in a position to introduce other evidence on the three-part test. Is that correct or incorrect?
Well, I don't see how it would have been possible to do that in the representation case proceeding.
No, I'm before.
But, however, it is possible that in the unfair labor practice proceeding,
let me just be clear. You're so much more familiar with this than I am that I'm trying to be clear. There is no general counsel or representative other than the hearing officer
at
the representation hearing. So if the evidence isn't put in by the union or by the respondent, there is no evidence.
Correct.
Now, if the college here had asked the board to review the Catholic bishop holding by the hearing officer, the general counsel would have been in the proceeding before the board. Is that correct?
That's not correct.
All right. So is there no general counsel in here until the unfair labor practice complaint?
That's correct. That's correct.
So if the issue had been before the board, would the board have been confined to the record that was before the regional director?
I believe that's the case, although I don't know of anything that would have prevented the board from issuing an order remanding it for the further development of record evidence here. But there was certainly no reason for the board to do that here, where we had an express concession that the board had jurisdiction under Catholic Bishop. Just one other point. The employer argued on this jurisdictional issue, the employer argues that in its reply brief, that no purpose is served by applying Section 10E here. But the courts have held that Section 10E is mandatory, not discretionary, and there are two interests that are served by applying 10E here. The first is the one articulated by the Supreme Court in Tucker Truck Lines, where the court explained that simple fairness to those who are engaged in the tasks of administration requires that, as a general rule, courts not topple over decisions made by the administrative body, unless the administrative body is not only erred, but is erred against objection made at the appropriate time. The other interest that serve is the interest in avoiding delay in implementing election results. The time for raising this argument was before the election was ever held, not 2 years after the fact. Now, the board also reasonably found that the college failed to show that the faculty are managers because the college failed to show that the faculty members control or effectively control academic affairs beyond their own classrooms. There's no evidence that the administration is bound by the faculty's views on academic affairs. There's no evidence that the faculty
can. They don't have to be bound.
They don't have to be bound. Yeshiva says there's various ways faculty can be deemed to have control or effective control over academic affairs. One way is if the administration feels bound. Another way is if the faculty can overrule the administration's wishes regarding academic policy, and there's no evidence of that. Another way is if the administration feels constrained to reach a consensus with the faculty before acting in the academic policy sphere, and there's no evidence of that. The only reason why the college claims that its faculty are managers is because they say that the faculty exercises effective control over academic affairs by making effective recommendations. But in order to be deemed to exercise effective control, the faculty not only have to have the authority to make recommendations on their own, but the faculty recommendations have to be given systematic deference by the administration, and the college failed to show that here. Indeed, the record shows a regular pattern of overruling faculty.
35 tenure recommendations, the administration only rejected 7.
That's correct. Now, if you're asking how can that not be enough, the answer is really twofold. First of all, as the college itself concedes, faculty influence over tenure decisions is entitled to less weight than faculty authority in the academic policy sphere. But the factual answer to the question is that it's not enough to look at whether, you know, at an alleged supervisor, an alleged manager makes a recommendation and then to see, well, is that implemented? You also have to look at the process by which what happens after the recommendation's made. Is deference given to that recommendation? The college says that it is because we don't second-guess the faculty committee members' assessment of the tenure candidate's academic qualifications. But that argument is belied by the provost, who testified that after the faculty make their recommendation, she makes her own independent judgment. And why? Because, quote, this is coming from her, the provost herself, because I'm just as capable, end quote, of judging their academic merit as they are. That's not deference.
All that's saying is there are different interests here, right? There's an interest from the perspective of the administration, interest from the perspective of the faculty. And I think what we're supposed to look at is, at the end of the day, is the faculty getting control here. And are their recommendations being accepted?
Well, I think...
Isn't that it? Are they systematically accepting or rejecting their recommendations?
Well, I think that's the smaller picture question. The bigger picture question is, managers, by definition, as the Supreme Court pointed out in Yeshiva, have to be deemed to be aligned with management. If there's a divergence between the institution's interest and the faculty's interest, then I think it would be difficult to conclude that the faculty are managers. It's not as if there's a difference over pay. I mean, surely they never would have voted for a union if they were aligned on pay. That's not the question. The question is, with respect to academic affairs beyond their own classrooms, are their interests aligned?
Well, how about this January term? Because if the faculty were truly toothless, the administration would have stuck with closing it down, and instead they shortened it and started charging for it. So they listened to the faculty. And I know it takes more than listening to the faculty, but to me that was a fairly clear example of the administration, with all of the financial considerations it has, it's still going to do what it can in academics to follow what the faculty wants, which is to keep this term. And
I don't think that's a fair reading of the testimony of the entire record.
Okay.
I mean, it's a fair reading of the testimony they rely on, the college relies on. But if you look at the passages that we cite in our brief, what happened here was that during the January term, before the elimination of the 414 academic calendar, the faculty was able to teach a substantial number of classes and lead foreign study abroad trips. That is out the window now. So, I mean, it may be true that the college, there still is some middle vacation session and some opportunity to take some classes, but there has been a substantive impact on academics. And if I could, just in my final 30 seconds, the college makes this argument that if an administration overrules a faculty regarding academic matters, that does not undermine finding a managerial status as long as the overruling is due to financial considerations. They cite three cases in support of that proposition: Yeshiva, Lemoyne Owen, and Lewis and Clark College. None of those cases stands for that blanket proposition. The Second Circuit in Yeshiva, in deciding the faculty to be managers, noted that in response to budget limitations, it was the faculty which recommended eliminating elective courses and scheduling changes. Similarly, the Supreme Court noted in Yeshiva that even when financial problems restricted Yeshiva's budget, faculty recommendations still largely controlled personnel decisions within the constraints imposed by the administration. In our case, it's not as if the administration said, look, we're having a financial crisis, we need to save money, we need to eliminate six majors, you tell us which majors we should eliminate. That's not what happened here. What happened here was is that the college, the administration, told the faculty, we, the administration, have decided to eliminate these specific named six majors.
Well, but it's because they had, isn't this right? Because they had, the administration had the records or the evidence or whatever to show that those were the courses that were not either producing, they were majors, I mean, that had a small number of students. In other words, the cost effectiveness again.
Well, sure, but you know, there's more than one way to skin a cat. There's more than one way to save money. And the college, I think the point is in Cooper Union, which is the Second Circuit case, which comes from the very same circuit which decided Yeshiva, the Second Circuit squarely held it, this is 783 F. Second at page 33, footnote 7, the consequence of the actions that the administration took in response to serious financial pressures may be to make a college faculty non-managerial. There, as here, the administration eliminated curriculum leading to certain designated majors. There, as here, the administration restructured the school. This was all done to save money, and yet the Second Circuit, which the same circuit which decided the faculty were managers in Yeshiva, had no trouble finding that the faculty in that case were non-managerial. And in Lemoyne Owen,
doesn't Lewis and Clark, the board's decision of Lewis and Clark, cut against you?
Respectfully, it does not, because although it is true that there, as in Lemoyne Owen, the board stated that faculty can be managers even if they don't control finances, In Lewis and Clark College, the board found the faculty to be managerial in part because, this is at page 163, 300 NLRB at 163, administration vetoes of faculty recommendations involved non-academic matters. In our case, the vetoes or the overruling is all concerning academic matters. The board also noted that when the college faced a financial crisis, it created an umbrella PRC committee, 50% of whom were faculty members, and it was that committee which was charged with recommending which academic programs should be maintained, reduced, or eliminated. That's not what happened in this case. The administration did not come to the faculty and say, we're having a crisis, you give us recommendations about what should be cut. Instead, they decided on their own, these are the six majors we want to get rid of. And in Lemoyne Owen, it's true that the board again said that faculty can be managers even if they don't control finances, but the board also noted that there was no evidence that any faculty curricular recommendations had ever been rejected because of the dean's involvement resulting from financial implications. So in conclusion, the board respectfully requests that the court enforce the board's order. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Crafton?
May it please the court, Catherine Trafton for the intervener UAW. I wanted to make a point both about the Catholic Bishop Tenney argument as well as one about the managerial question. So first, with respect to this question of whether we have extraordinary circumstances here, the UAW certainly agrees with the board that this argument under Catholic Bishop is precluded by Section 10E. And whether there are extraordinary circumstances is an important question, and we would assert that there are not extraordinary circumstances here, in part because it's not patently obvious that the board doesn't have jurisdiction. And this goes to the Great Falls argument with respect to the board's jurisdiction.
If the issue had been brought to the board, what other evidence would you have?
I think that the evidence that, so if you look at the record testimony, the president of the college testified a very small amount about the asserted affiliation of the college with the Presbyterian Church. But I think that there would have been a number of questions that could have been asked about how that affiliation manifests itself in terms of what the way that the education is provided at the college and in terms of the way that the college is run.
They don't, under Great Falls, they don't need to do any of that. There's a simple test under Great Falls.
Well,
they hold themselves out to the public as being a religious institution. And Great Falls adopted that test just so that we would avoid the type of questions you're asking.
The Great Falls test, as I read it, has three parts. And in order for the three parts to each mean something, it can't be that the college's mere assertion that it's affiliated with the Presbyterian Church is enough, because the court in Great Falls established first that it holds itself out as providing a religious educational environment, that it's a nonprofit, and then finally that it's affiliated with, owned, operated, or controlled directly or indirectly by a recognized religious organization. Those three prongs can't simply mean that if the college says we're affiliated with the Presbyterian Church since 1850, that that's enough. We won't have to go trolling into the college's religious mission to ask some very simple questions about how much control does the church, in fact, have over this college.
Where do you get control as an element of Great Falls?
Where I get that is if you
affiliated. Let's take the least onerous, and it's affiliated, right? Do you deny that the college is affiliated with the Presbyterian Church? Is that a matter of dispute?
We agree that they've asserted that they're affiliated with the Presbyterian Church and that they have a covenant with the Presbyterian Church. What we disagree with is that could be enough under the Great Falls test to establish that it's a church-operated school exempt from the NLRB jurisdiction. And we get that from reading.
You use the phrase church-operated school. Where does that come from? That's not in the law. That's not in Great Falls.
That's in Catholic Bishop, I believe.
Yeah, we're going by Great Falls, right?
So in Great Falls, the question of affiliation was not, there was no question. Nobody disputed that this religious institution was, in fact, run by the sisters. There was no question that it was funding the school. That's very different than what we have here. We don't have evidence that there is any relationship between.
Maybe I'm wrong. So in the spirit of Judge Rogers' earlier questions about to the other counsel in the previous case, clarify this for me. It's my understanding that in Great Falls, there are three questions that we ask. And in reverse order, is it affiliated with a religious institution? Is it a nonprofit organization? And then third, does it hold itself out to the public as being a religious school? Is that your understanding of Great Falls as well?
That is my understanding. And the language, you know, in a
church operated school isn't part of it. That would certainly fit with under the third prong, but it's not required that it be a church-operated school.
Right, but if you look, it's not just the third prong of the Great Falls test is not just affiliated. It says affiliated with or owned or operated or controlled directly or indirectly by a recognized religious organization. I'm not sure I understand the need for the modifiers if a mere assertion of an affiliation would be enough. We have to be getting at, if there's a constitutional question that's going to be raised, it has to be because of the relationship between the college and the church. So without, like I said, trolling into the religious, you know, beliefs of the college, we have to have some gathering of evidence about the relationship between the two to show that there is, in fact, more than just a piece of paper that says, you know, we like each other. We share some values. That can't be enough to do something as drastic as, you know, removing an employer from the jurisdiction of the National Labor Relations Board. And I think this court acknowledged in Great Falls that, you know, we needed to avoid.
And you think that's drastic to remove somebody from the jurisdiction of the board?
I'm just
playing with your language.
I still believe that the National Labor Relations Act means something to the workers who want to, you know, exercise their rights under it. And by virtue of a decision to exempt their employer, they've lost that right. And so I do think that's drastic.
All right, any other questions? All right, thank you. Let's see. Does Mr. Brill have any?
No.
All right, why don't you take 2 minutes?
Your Honors. I recognize that the issue of Section 10E is a difficult issue for us to be raising or asking the court to do something unusual. But if I don't do anything else in these 2 minutes, I want to make clear one thing to the court in response to Judge Rogers' line of questions and the statements by Ms. Trafton, which were, I think, completely misleading. The college stated at the outset of the hearing that it was raising a jurisdictional question because of its religious character. It made no difference under the board law at that time whether the issue was raised under RFRA or Catholic bishop. RFRA was never mentioned, and it was the board applied the same test, so it was the same evidence. There was no issue that if Mr. Leffler had said we're raising a Catholic bishop issue and not a RFRA issue, that it would have been some different questioning. In fact, the UAW's I think you can easily find, I don't know if you have to find it, but you certainly can find it.
Well, if there's a possibility, you know, substantial probability, I mean, that the board might want additional evidence.
I mean, the record was.
I'm just trying to understand how this process works, and that's where my questions are going, is that it's one thing if everybody says, look, you have no jurisdiction under this statute. All right, so everybody's focusing on that. Now, your strongest argument is, well, the regional director went off in this footnote and decided Catholic bishop as well. Now we're under the three-part Great Falls test, and that's what you want us to address. And it seems to me we would have to find that the board would have had no occasion to ask for any further development of the record, and maybe they would have. And then your other argument is it really doesn't matter what the board might have thought because the question is one that the court has to decide. There's no expertise involved. So we're stuck with the record that was before the regional director, and you either win or lose on that.
Well, those are two questions, and if I may, I know the red light is on, but if I may answer those and just make one other brief point. The second question, I think, was, are we saying that we're stuck with the record? And the answer is yes, the record is the record. We're not asking for any additional record, nor do I think there's an occasion for it, because, as I said, it was the same issue that was before the board, and the regional director didn't address it just in a footnote. It was the very first part of his opinion. What he addressed in a footnote was the Great Falls test. And the UAW's post-hearing brief, which is attached as an addendum to our reply brief, has a whole section that starts out saying Carroll College is not exempt from the jurisdiction of the NLRB. And what does it discuss? Catholic bishop and Great Falls. Everybody understood at the hearing that that was the issue. because the issue as the, under board law at that time, that was the issue for the regional director to decide. If he, the board said, we analyze it under Catholic bishop, and then that governs our decision under RFRA. So the record was fully developed, and I mean, of course, anybody could always go back and say, oh, if I had another chance at the hearing, I'd put in more evidence. But frankly, this evidence was all documentary, and I don't know that there's anything more that could have been put in. And I just want to make, actually refer the court to page 6 of our brief on the question raised by Judge Griffith. And if I can have 1 minute, the statement of Christian purpose of the college, which is publicly published in all the documents, says, the college's mission is by means of a faculty dedicated to the Christian purpose to provide a learning environment devoted to academic excellence and congenial to Christian witness, that the college seeks to continue an active exchange between the Christian faith and the academic disciplines, leading to new insights and greater depth of faith, and provides an opportunity for all to encounter Christ and to engage in his mission in the world, and also to make a student body aware of the Christian faith, which affirms the lordship of Christ over the lives and works of men. Now, the regional director said it doesn't count because it's aspirational. I don't think that's what Great Falls is about. That says to anybody, anybody who looks at this statement of purpose knows this college has a Christian purpose in providing a secular education in a Christian environment. That's what, that's exactly what Great Falls is about. And should
be clear though, do you think that Great Falls is satisfied if a hypothetical college that is otherwise secular, and if I am a student, I can take only secular courses and never come into contact with any religious element whatsoever, other than the fact that the course catalog has a statement, Christ and learning?
You get dangerously close to what Great Falls says is not the function of the board, which is to look at how effective the college is in putting...
What I'm getting at, though, is
what
I think that the argument that's being made is that in other cases, we've had a lot more evidence.
Absolutely.
All right, so this is closer. And we're in this 10E situation. And that's where my questions have come from, simply that when you're in this closer situation, we're basically saying, you're saying, you'll stand on the record, and it's enough as to what was put before the regional director to show that you meet Great Falls.
Well, both Bayamón and Great Falls were secular, provided a secular education, and what the court said in Great Falls is that there's always a danger that some secular institution may latch on to this exception in an effort to exclude itself from the act. And all I can say here is that didn't happen here. This college has been affiliated for 160 years with the Presbyterian Church. This is a genuine bona fide relationship. It does hold itself out to the public as a Christian institution. The Presbyterian Church, as part of the covenant, recruits students for the institution. And what the court said in Great Falls is that the market will prevent misuse of this exemption. So, you know, if you go out and hold yourself out as a Christian institution, you're going to be there are a lot of people who may not want to go to a religious institution, and we will rely on the simple, objective, bright-line test, because once we start looking at how religious is it, and do they require students to take religion courses, and what do they do to really inculcate their religious values, that's the road that this court said we don't want to go down. And so I don't think this is a close case. I think it would be a closer case under a substantial religious character test.
All right, wind it up if you would, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. For the reasons stated, we urge the court to set aside the board's order. Thank you.
All